Hello, and welcome to Dopey, the podcast about drugs, addiction, and dumb shit. And I'm Dave.
And I'm Chris.
And Dopey Nation, you're really not going to believe this one. We are in a penthouse on 95th Street and Summer Avenue in Manhattan. And who is here? But please introduce yourself.
Drew Pinsky.
Dr. Drew Pinsky.
This is good. It's a privilege.
Yeah. It's a privilege for us.
It's an honor and a privilege for us, yes.
Now, we've been doing this show for about 2 years, and we have a very, very rabid and kind of half in treatment and half on drugs and a tiny bit of just voyeuristic people.
I love it.
And it's such a treat to have somebody like you on the show. I know you were in the White House last week.
Yes.
I know you were at MTV.
Yes.
Howard Stern. And
didn't you say you were stalking somebody else? I feel like I was being stalked.
I stalk everybody.
Universal stalker.
I'm the all stalker.
All-purpose stalker.
But Dopey has to be the high end of the week.
Oh, of course. I was looking forward to this forever. You guys were early. I felt guilty. Yeah. It's terrible.
You?
I was working out. I'm like, I'm running across the street to go see you guys. It's great.
Awesome. I got to take my hat off to you. You're inviting in a couple ex-junkies into your apartment, your house. You know, that's amazing.
Well, that was my wife and not me. I'm not sure she knew the junkie part, yeah, but I wouldn't have objected. I wouldn't have objected. And you and I have a special relationship, which is very meaningful and thrilling for me, frankly.
Yes, and we were throwing around some names before we started recording here. And the Dopey Nation knows I recorded one episode. I said a little bit about it. And I didn't want to actually go into details before we got on the show, but I'm just going to sort of recap how I met you. So for the members who are tuning in and don't know, Dr. Drew was my treating physician.
I was one of your treating physicians.
One of many.
I was the addictionologist running the program with another guy that you were in.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so just to refresh your memory, I'll tell you what happened. And so I had relapsed. I was in the Pasadena area, and I would do the thing kind of up and down Colorado Boulevard, you know, the little...
So they know your whole backstory, how you got across the country and everything?
Oh, yeah.
Dopey Nation. Everybody knows your story.
The whole story, okay?
Please, every episode is the same story. Yeah.
The war stories. Oh, for God's sakes. Yeah. The opialogs.
I'm sure you know this. You remember Swiss Lodge. Is that even still there? Just little shitty motels.
Yeah.
So I ended up there, and it got kind of hard. I did the same thing I always did. I called my parents. I said, help. And they said, go to the hospital, you know, in Pasadena where you were working at this period. And so I went and checked in and I...
Let me ask you a real quick question. You were on TV then too. Loveline was booming.
TV was always something I did in my sort of my free time. Yeah. I literally, like Loveline, when we did that in the late 90s, I literally said, look, all right, you guys want to do this? I can do it on Friday afternoon and Saturday afternoon, and that's it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm doing medicine.
So were your folks like, there's this famous doctor, I got to get you to him?
They knew who you were. I had no clue, but that was not the intention. It was just a reputable hospital in the area, and I had already gone to another place called Impact, which is a real strict therapeutic community.
So let me give you the landscape of treatment in Pasadena at the time, right? There was Impact House, which was where the hardcore went, the reluctant to recover. We were the court ordered them, typically.
Yeah.
And we loved Impact. And we would send a lot of our difficult people, like yourself, up to Impact. Yeah. And if people failed Impact, then we were concerned.
Yeah.
There was places like Bishop Gooden and Casa de las Amigas. Yeah. Bishop Gooden is this salt of the earth standard. It's like run by a bunch of old alcoholics.
Yeah.
There's a rich community of recovering alcoholics in Pasadena from literally almost the mid 20th century.
Yeah, because it was such a nice climate, such a beautiful place to be.
No, it really was a bunch of highly successful government and business people that got in a shit ton of trouble and needed to get sober.
Wow.
And it was sort of Akron light, you know.
Yeah.
It was like a little. Okay. It was sort of one of those settled. We had a society, the alcoholism society or something there that was 100 years old. It was really like it just came from Ohio to Pasadena. You know, there was a lot of connections there. So Bishop Gooden and Costa is great, and then there were the hospitals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we really were the place that could handle anything. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you were polydiagnosed, if you were sick medically, if you had multiple psychiatric problems and severe medical consequences from your addiction, whatever it was, When everybody else was done, we get them.
Yeah.
And we can handle you. Now, we couldn't necessarily make everybody better, yeah. but we could handle you.
Yeah.
And we could try. We were equipped to handle everything.
Clinically complex cases.
Which was great for me because I love seeing that stuff. And that's sort of my expertise is getting somebody started in recovery. That's my thing.
Yeah.
And so here you come.
Yeah.
Off impact.
Well, it was my parents collaborating with my attorney. And so it was the scared straight sort of impact. And at this point, I was just doing really crazy stuff. And they were like,
what?
You must have. You know,
a psychiatric problem.
A psychiatric
problem. And to be fair to them, you look psychiatric. That's our job is trying to figure out what's psych, what's not, what's BS. Yeah.
And what he looked like then.
I'll show you a picture after.
It was intense.
I kind of remember.
Yeah. He kind of looked like Bluto from Popeye. You know, the thick beard, the beady, shifty eyes.
Yes. And so during this period, my mom has them all written down.
He's such a beautiful boy now.
He is. He's my beautiful boy. I hope he,
Anyway, continue.
So I ended up on just tons of psychiatric medicine. I haven't taken
at our facility or before.
Some before, the most at your facility.
Tell the story. This part.
Now, we didn't like to let that happen. So that means we lost control of you.
Yeah, no. So you actually came in to rectify the problem.
Okay.
I was in the chemical dependency unit. But before that, what I did was I came in and I had been stealing beef jerky from, grocery stores and drinking a few 40s a day. And I had this idea. This was actually an original thought. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go in and pretend to be withdrawing really, really bad, fake symptoms. And so
From what?
I sat on my hand. I told him I was drinking
from alcohol.
I lied and told him I was drinking a handle of vodka a day, shooting a bundle of dope, and taking benzos. And I pretended to be shaking, right? And they admitted me to... I won't go into the specifics.
I want clinicians. I want physicians to listen to this story because the number one problem with the care of drug addicts today, and that's what you got into with some of your psychiatrists, they believe drug addicts. They believe.
Yeah.
They believe everything they say,
yeah.
as opposed to believe nothing they say and try to figure out what the truth is. That's your goddamn job.
Well, Chris and I were talking last night, and Chris was saying that in a place like that, they want to keep them comfortable. They're so worried about
I have a personal belief that when you get to higher end care, we're talking $30,000 plus a month.
Yeah.
You're working with a demographic that is used to getting what they want. So controlled substances, I'm not like a never type of person, but it's a use sparingly situation with drug addicts.
Yeah.
And when you go to really, really high end facilities, you'll see most of the people there are on it. And it's like, it should be a small percentage.
Not only that, but the whole foundation of treatment is frustration, not gratification. And because drug addicts want it easier, kinder, whatever, and if they have money, they demand it. And if somebody meets that need, well, that's where they're all going.
Yeah, exactly.
So our goal, this is one of your Dr. F's, one of your psychologists' phrases for us as a team was always optimal frustration. Let's provide optimal frustration for the patient.
That.
So enough frustration they don't bolt out of here.
Yeah.
But frustration and what can they tolerate?
And then raise that a little bit more.
Right. But we're not going to make it tolerate. Yeah. We'll just take it right where they can tolerate and try to hold it there. Try to figure out what that is.
My recovery wheelhouse was always the shittiest detoxes, and I would be coming off of heroin and benzos, and all I would get is clonidine. And it would be misery. It would be the exact opposite of this story.
So I go in, I feign all these symptoms, and they started me on 32 milligrams of Suboxone. I had no.
Oh, so you weren't near.
It was two E's.
So we
can bleep anything.
But I wouldn't allow that on our unit.
Yeah.
And it drove the hospital crazy because. Everyone's treated with that. Everyone drug addict wants that. And I'm like, look, I can't run the unit. If there's an opiate on the unit and one person is getting it, the other person isn't, unravels. Yeah. He's getting what am I getting?
Classic.
And I can't run the unit. Yeah. So I said, no opiates, no benzos, period, on my unit, period.
Even then? Even
absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
He was on a different unit.
You were basically brought in, you and Blum were brought in. And so I lied about that. They gave me a loading dose of 100 milligrams of Librium, and they gave me a PRN repeat of like 50 every half hour.
By the way, with the Suboxone?
With the Suboxone.
Super dangerous.
Super
dangerous.
So listen what happened. So I kept going back for the – I blacked out. I lost 2 weeks, right?
You must have been so proud of yourself and happy and self-satisfied.
Well, the medical max, I think, for Librium is like 400 a day.
No, but we would use – that may be partly my fault because I advocated large doses of Librium for severe alcoholics. Yeah. If you come in at a handle a day, you're going to get 400 milligrams of Librium.
Okay.
But you're not Suboxone with That's crazy.
I kept on getting the PRN and the PRN, and we went way past it. It went to like 700 or 800 milligrams. I lost 2 weeks of time,
Jesus.
And they had to take me to Huntington Hospital.
Oh, my God.
And then they brought me back, and I was in a bunch of different places, and finally they were like, I think this is just like, and they were, is it a psychiatric? I think this is just like a chemical dependency program problem. And they put me into Breyer.
Yeah.
And I met you.
Did we come up there? Did we come up there to see you, or you came down to us?
I don't remember. Yeah. What I remember of our interactions was sitting in an office and asking you and Bob Forrest, how can you prove this is reality? And Bob Forrest saying something like, either way, you're going to die. Doesn't even matter if you die in your head or
Bob,
not.
Bob with his hat and his glasses on. Yeah. Going,
and I liked it because he'd point at you and laugh. And like, I needed that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so
we find
you
addicts.
Figured it out, though. You said, you or Blum, I don't remember which one, but you said, did you drug test him when he came in?
Blum was really good about picking up the bullshit. So probably him.
Yeah.
And they would offer. That's why I was loved being around recovering people, because I couldn't, some of the levels of bullshit I couldn't even like ascertain, couldn't imagine.
Yeah.
And they'd go like, yeah, that's just that drug addict stuff.
But sifting through the bullshit must be one of the most complicated parts of
it. It's the job. It is the job. And why people don't understand that, and they think their job is to medicate withdrawal or cravings. That is not the job.
Yeah.
That is not the job. And it makes me insane.
Yeah.
That's when I was in Washington, I was starting to get into that conversation. Hopefully they'll have me back. I've upset some people. But
who were you talking to in Washington?
Kellyanne and the head of the VA were my two main listened
head
most
of the
to
VA.
Me.
Wow.
He was
they
great.
Had all the
Shulkin.
Money. They dictate where we go.
Yeah, but he may be gone because he was caught using taxpayer dollars for paying too much for an airline ticket or something. And that's a shame because he's a good clinician. He was listening to me carefully.
Yeah.
And I thought that's where I'm going to get my inroad, and then now they're saying he may lose a job. But anyway, but so you're bullshitting. You're
bullshitting.
Here, but here's what Bob and I and Blum to some extent too. We would love that. We just love drug addicts. They're so funny.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we laughed our asses off.
Yeah.
Like we're like.
And you know what? For a lot of us, like that's actually important.
Of course,
though, you know?
Of course it is. It's real.
Yeah.
You're really being funny, and it's like.
Well, not to mention, you didn't mention your Matrix obsession at the time.
Yeah, I was obsessed.
Well,
with
that's
the
what
Matrix,
this was. That's what was going on here.
And I used to wait in the parking lot for you, and I would ask. I had the little single right near like the medicine area.
Oh, great.
And I'd ask, can my girlfriend come in my room? And you'd be like. No, like could she visit? No, she's not allowed in your room. Yeah,
it's so you were. That's actually. Easy, you know what I mean? You were, you at that point are easy.
It's easy,
like,
no.
It's like, dude, come on. But the point is, heroin addicts and multi drug users and the benzos and everything, they don't know where they are. Mm-hmm. And if you can point at something real about them, like you're fucking full of shit, or you're funny, or they're like. Yeah. How'd you see me?
You got me.
Yeah. It's like, let's go. Maybe you can do something for me. I do want to get well. I just can't.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll fast forward and just do a real recap, like a quick recap of what happened.
I got to see the picture.
That was 2 months.
Maybe it'll jar my memory. Yeah.
That was two months into Las Encinas. And so I was there 8 months.
Oh,
I learned
Jesus.
That if you flipped out there, they tied you to the board and they gave you the booty juice. So I started intentionally, and there's a little Ativan in there with the Haldol, and it feels good for a second. So I started intentionally doing that.
Were you in our out in the Nash house at that point?
I was in the Nash. I was in Nash, Gables, 2 East, 2
No, but
West,
when you started faking stuff.
I was out of Breyer because I completed Breyer.
But did you go to Nash?
They moved me to Gables, and they had just reopened Gables.
Oh, what a mess.
Yeah.
Where was the thing where you were breaking windows and doing all that?
That was in Pack. So in Pack, that's where they gave you the juice quickly.
The booty juice.
Were you the upstairs one or the one out?
I was downstairs.
Its own unit.
With the fences.
Its own unit,
its own unit.
Yeah.
And then so what happened is I got transferred around and it became more of a psychiatric issue, they thought. And just to clarify, other than ADHD and the substance use disorder, that's it. I haven't taken medication since 2000.
Well, and to be fair, you may have had, I can't remember, but there are organic psychiatric conditions from the drugs you're using.
Like a stimulant-induced psychosis.
Or really manias and things from all the ups and downs. You can get, you start to be manic,
like
even though you're not bipolar. You look manic. And sounds like you had some of that stuff going on.
I had stuff going on. And but so by the end, my parents flew out to visit. I was seeing a different doctor and a different ward. board. And he had me on 1,200 milligrams of Seroquel a day. Four times a day, I'd get 300 milligrams of Seroquel, 1 milligram of Clonopin, and 8 milligrams of Suboxone. So I was sleeping 16 hours a day. I gained 60 pounds.
Oh.
My parents flew out to visit me, and my mom laughs about it now, and she said they were looking at me, and he came to the bedside with my parents, and she said it was the worst they'd ever seen me.
Yeah.
And he was like, doesn't he look great?
Who
said that?
Which one?
I mean, S. I can delete it.
It was S, yeah, yeah, please.
Why did you say the name? Now you have to find
it. Yes, who it was.
Yeah.
But I always say, though, like, I was pretty cunning. I probably had real symptoms going on,
yeah.
Some stuff going on. And I wanted medication. I wanted more. Dr. Gray there gave me the option of when I was on Zyprexa of getting the pill or the injection. And I was like, I'll take the injection.
Of course.
And he's like, I've never in 20 years had a patient actually opt for the injection. So
right.
That was
like,
I was med seeking
right.
in a psych
hospital. That should tell him something.
And then I'd always ask the nurse. Seeking. She would get it. She'd draw it up, and then you go in the bathroom, and she'd give it to you in the med line. And I'd always say, hey, just let me do it, because I thought maybe if I mainlined it, it would.
Oh, Jesus!
Dude, I was so crazy when I was there. At one point, I was cheeking my meds, and I had an old, like, it was like a syringe for a horse. It was like a 12-gauge, 5cc syringe in my belongings. And I remember cheeking Geodome, and I was just crushing and shooting my psych meds. And I drew it up.
You shoot them?
I drew it up, and the Geodome didn't mix with the blood, where it was like a milky white solution and blood.
God.
And I didn't care, and I just would fire it up. And I ended up going to, not from that, I'm going to the hospital for shooting alcohol in there. I was insane.
Out of control. Yeah, it's insanity. But all drug addicted. I had some crazy conversations with some of the powers that be over there when I kept saying, look, I want a banner somewhere that just says all the diagnostic criteria in the DSM-4 at the time apply only if it can't be explained on the basis of drug ingestion, drug addiction, medical problem. Please just put a banner up there, because they would just ignore that.
That's what when I was at Huntington Hospital, my parents loved him, and probably in part because they wanted to believe this, and it did happen to be true, is he said he would bet his career that I was not a bipolar 1 diagnosis.
No, good.
It was, and I'm not.
And that's what they had said in the beginning?
I mean, it was bipolar NOS, so they threw everything under the sink, you know what I mean? But because it was all untreated alcoholism manifests.
It's all organic.
Yeah.
It's all addiction and organic effective drugs. Those, and withdrawal.
And withdrawal.
And back and forth and back and forth.
And all of these things show their head through the spectrum of getting sober or getting high.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
I mean, you start showing symptoms of bipolar in the midst of, like, the worst drug run and drug seeking and taking drugs you're not supposed to have.
Well, then it's a chicken or the egg. And if I remember correctly, at Las Encinas, there was like sort of mission statements where it's like, we treat chemical dependency and then the co-occurring thing, or you might treat the co-occurring thing first and then the chemical dependency.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. That's a dangerous and challenging diathesis to figure out.
Yeah.
And your work, when you get into it, you're going to see, they know you're working on.
I don't say the school. We're anonymous with our first names, they can figure it out.
So when you get that ID, you'll see how challenging that can be. But your gut will tell you. You know, it always is. I don't say it's best, but you don't go far afield clinically by just going with the assumption first that it's chemical dependency, because it's so common, so pervasive.
And the more I've been around addiction, honestly, the less I know. And it's like, I know, for instance, the newest research, which appears sound, is that people with a substance use disorder, it's actually protective, and ADHD, it's protective to take a stimulant. And it's like, that seems
until crazy. The age of 18. Until the age of 18.
Is that a caveat?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because, I just know I can't take it. I'll take the whole bottle.
Right.
And it's like,
so till the age of 18, reduced risk of substance use disorder and reduce risk of personality disorders and better performance in academia.
Yeah.
So, and better social functioning.
Okay.
So somehow when that literature
is being applied, where now they're giving stimulants
people
in treatment and they're citing this research.
Not in adults. No,
they shouldn't.
No.
I know it doesn't work for me.
God. Yeah. If you don't ever do that, have a concentration problem.
How does that work where the stimulant is effective with underage?
Don't have any idea. And when I first started seeing that literature, I was during the sort of burgeoning 90s of the first amphetamine epidemic. I was like, well, of course, we're creating all these amphetamine. And I started looking at the literature very carefully. I'm like, oh my God, it's pretty conclusive that that's not what we're doing.
Yeah.
But in adulthood, totally different story.
He's saying because people, they thought, oh, you give
Adderall, you create. No, I understand. I totally understand. Yeah, yeah. What I also want to get to here is, like, all of this conversation is very much a couple feet over my head.
Okay, okay.
But I am a drug addict, and I am in recovery, and I think that it's important. Because one thing that Chris just said that I think is very crucial is, like, the more he learns, the less he knows.
Yeah.
And, like, we had this woman recently leave us this very, very convoluted but beautiful voicemail about when you're ambivalent.
And
when you
to
really
want, it, yeah.
want to stop, but you can't, you don't really want it.
Yeah.
And you want to
yeah.
stop.
Yeah.
And when you're as learned and as experienced as you are, what do you do with somebody like that?
Well, so it's sort of pre-contemplative, contemplative, we call that, where somebody's thinking about getting better. And that's good news. It's good news for her. It's unusual that somebody will spontaneously go from that to jumping in. That's the kind of person will jump in and out. And something probably bad is going to have to happen before she jumps in,
yeah.
or some sort of something that wakes her up a bit, that makes her motivated. Yeah. There are people that theorize you can do something called motivational enhancement interviews that may bring that forward a little bit.
What does that mean?
It's like change statements. You talk to somebody and you find something that they're important about and you harp on that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's another thing. I've been around, you know, I was...
it would not have worked on Chris in his disease.
I was an intravenous heroin addict for 12 years.
Yeah.
And I was in and out of shitty facility after shitty facility. I definitely do not have the pedigree that my friend has. You know?
And the reason I love Dave and everything is, like, I get all excited and start talking about this, but he knows me and I'm just like an egocentric person.
He just likes to
throw out big words. And, like, the truth is, like, I'm just a total doofus.
Slow down, Chris. But you're a drug addict that's egocentric? Hold on a second. I'm very confused. I'm so confused.
But the truth is that, first of all, I want to thank you again for being on, because this is his wet dream to be able to talk terms,
yeah, but you gotta
medications,
understand.
Dosages, be valued for his schooling. Yeah. Look at him.
But listen, you gotta understand something. The guys like this is what just... I don't know how to describe it. It gives me faith, I guess, is the best word.
Good.
It gives me enthusiasm for treatment. It gives me the capability of, like, really feeling good about going forward. People, particularly people that go into training, mental health training, I'm always blown away when people do that. And a lot of people do it.
Yeah.
Because I dealt with the very, very reluctant to get sober, the very sick. Mm-hmm. And when they get well, they remain interested in mental health and stuff. And they want to know more about it.
Yeah, I didn't want to do it for the longest time. And I was like, because I thought it was a cop out. I was like, everybody gets sober and then they work in the field.
Yeah.
And then somebody challenged me and they're like, well, it's also a cop out if you're just not even trying it for that reason.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, you're doing something different. Who knows what you're going to end up doing? You may end up eating disorder or something. Or
yeah.
Who knows? It may just interest you and that'll fulfill you and that's what you'll do. But the fact that you're doing that is just amazing.
But that's another thing that we talk about on the show, that the greatest evidence that I have in being clean, I mean, I have a family that I love to be a part of. I love to be a father. I love to be a partner. I love to be an adult. You know, I was a child for 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to be an adult for a moment. But what I love is the idea of actualizing an idea, of doing something that, you know, fulfilling an idea.
Yeah, of course.
And I think for Chris, actualizing himself as an actual clinician, as a PsyD, it takes everything he knows. And it goes from the dark side of the force to the light.
Well, right,
you know,
and
he was
look,
like a Sith Jedi fucking junkie.
I understand that. I was there. I had my lightsaber out.
Exactly.
But you understand something. His experience will inform his clinical acumen, and it will be very useful for people.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, what it was. I mean, I got to that cap in my own life where, I mean, it's such a fucking, the cliche of you when you're so tired of being sick and tired where you're, but you actually get, you can say that cliche for as long as you want, but until there's a, you know, a
experience,
it doesn't happen.
I know.
You find that to be incredibly frustrating. Is that, like, the most frustrating part of the job?
Is that the most frustrating part of the job?
But you can't make that happen.
It used to bother me. I had to, it requires a lot of humility to really believe that I ultimately can't do that much, but I'm going to do whatever I can do. And if somebody would show up, and again, I would run into Chris's, in my life all of a sudden, and I'd go, I have faith that anybody can get sober now. I mean, if that guy can be here doing that, the horrible, horrible, messed up whatever I'm dealing with right now that looks like they're just not going to make it, they don't have a prayer, I remain hopeful. because of Chris.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Look at you, Chris.
And I've got a few of them like you out there.
I got to be cautious because the more good stuff that goes into Chris, the more danger.
I'm relapse now because you're saying all this stuff.
Just take it easy.
I understand. I understand. I understand the potential.
Ego strokes are dangerous.
Yeah. You know I took a jab at him the minute before that, though. You saw
that? So you know what you're
doing. Tempered it, yeah.
That is good. And the other thing is like our thing, you know, us trying to, you know, I make a joke about this all the time, but we're trying to treat addiction with comedy.
It's funny. People are funny, and it's never more funny than when they're drug addicts. You told the story about The Matrix and me and Bob. You just did. Yeah, Bob Forrest.
And that was episode number three.
Yeah. I mean, that's so funny. Yeah. And I'm sure Bob and I just laughed our asses off and went on to the next person who entertained us endlessly with their bullshit. And it's like, who are you talking to? It's like, good luck, man.
That's like one of our taglines is that people will tune in for the debauchery and end up staying for the recovery, and it's that
the rope
stages of change thing you were just talking about. It's like the pre-contemplate people listen, and the beauty is if we can even take them to that contemplative state and they start noticing other things in their life.
Yeah,
but we didn't intend to do that. We were just like, let's tell some crazy drug stories, and then we started to like hear stuff.
We are in a spiritual vacuum in this country right now, and you guys are just the tip of the iceberg with the illness that you manifested, right? I think the lack of community and the lack of connection amongst Americans particularly is at the core of this. And recovery, of course, is about reestablishing deep connection with sober peers and your sponsor and whatnot. But this, I have this feeling that podcast may save the universe here because podcasts are these little communities that develop. And it's kind of an intimate interaction. We all put our headphones in and we're working out or driving. Yeah. And I really have a lot of faith in things like this. So so I'm hoping that it does.
You get started for $100.
It's democratic as hell. But more importantly, it's the community that you build and the people attached to your stories and attached to you and have this sort of – it's not even a unidirectional relationship. It gets bidirectional because you also develop a website and they have chats.
We constantly are interacting with these people.
So what is your – you have five podcasts, right?
I guess
what's your favorite one?
What's your favorite?
If that's okay.
Well, my wife produces two of them, so those are my favorite.
Which one?
She does the all – Susan, you out there?
Yeah.
Do a little pitch of your podcast. She does anything hashtag you live. That's all, Susan.
Okay.
You live versus don't die.
That Bob is don't die.
Yeah, we have Dr. Drew. Don't die.
Okay, don't die is Bob. Come on. Put your face in here.
Quick. Yeah.
Okay. This life
with
hashtag
now,
you live,
and that's now
Bob Forrest.
Bob Forrest all the time, and then we have
that's with celebrities and addicts.
It's sort of more in the recovery zone, but not. We wanted it to be about life generally, you know, just and use, you know, sort of the things we've seen
and being alive,
informing that.
I said, don't. Yeah, this life.
Well, don't die was Bob. Yeah, Bob has Bob's a don't die thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think he gave.
It's a great
thing. All right, then we have the Swole Patrol with Mike Cowley. That was sort of a health and fitness thing.
The Swole Patrol. Yeah, yeah.
So that's a new thing. That's a new thing.
And it's doing well. It's for people who want to get swole. And then we have Weekly Infusion, which is a medically based interaction.
Dr. Bruce and I do a real medical, you know, real medical thing.
And then you
hardcore
do the one
medical.
With Adam Carolla.
Then I do a daily thing with Adam Carolla.
And then there's the Dr. Drew podcast.
It's a daily podcast.
How do you do it when you're here?
We bank them. Yeah. We do a bunch of them.
Uh-huh.
And then the Dr. Drew podcast was just sort of a free form interview.
That's
with
like the flagship one, sort of?
Sort of. Just one that interests me. It's just whatever comes up. Carolla talked me into the one with him and the one on my own, and that's how it all got started. And then Susan spun off with these
just
other ones.
Just go to drdrew.com and they're all there.
There you go. I knew she could do better than I could.
So, and she mentioned getting swole. I might add that Dr. Drew is in phenomenal
shape. Thank you. I'm working at it. I'm sorry. These guys.
The level of. What about people pleasing? In this world,
the underlying many addicts is a codependent.
Yes,
and so
well, I forgot mine too.
Uh-oh,
calling out with Susan Pinsky.
There you go.
Calling out with Susan Pinsky.
So what I want to do for my doctoral project, which is like my dissertation, is: are you familiar with like adult romantic attachment styles? Anxious, avoidant.
Yes, which are really just part of your adult attachment styles.
In general, yes. And some of it's rooted in the infant caregiver or the Bowlby studies and stuff. And so for my doctoral project, they say 60% of people are securely attached, and the rest fall either into the anxious avoidant or anxious avoidant.
Not amongst drug addicts.
That's what I'm saying. I want to do a high sample and show a formal relationship because I just romance and finance are the biggest.
They all have attachment stuff. All of them, and whether or not it's really a chronic thing or just in their disease, I don't know. But they are all. I always saw, just so you know, one of my primary job was to form an attachment. And that's why...
With your client.
It's a little more complicated because there's trauma too. There's all trauma in a drug addict's background. And so there's no trust, there's no connections, no attunement because it's all, I'm just going to fix myself. I can't trust anybody. And then the addiction kicks in and then it's off to the races. But if you noticed, that's why we would have so many different people interact with you. And often we'd be together, like me and Bob, me and Sasha. Remember Sasha?
I don't remember
She had an accent a little bit.
I do.
Yeah. She would be in with me always because you would attach differently to different personalities.
Who was the woman on the show?
Shelly. I don't think Shelly was there yet when you were there. Yeah. But each of us would give you an opportunity to form an attachment. And like Sasha loved sociopaths. And we were like, whenever she really had found somebody entertaining, we were like, oh shit, here we go. But she would form a connection with them, and so and that would inform how we would then approach them too, because we would then try to get an inroad with what isn't otherwise a more comfortable attachment. Uh-huh. You know, sociopaths go for certain kinds of people and that they can manipulate and whatnot. But we're like, okay, it's sociopath. Well, we know we're going to try to form an attachment with that guy. And I always, because in my own therapy, I had all kinds of attachment stuff, and I was in therapy for 11 years, and when I was sort of towards the end of it, it really helped me navigate these things. To be able to find a way to just get close to a client, and then I would tell them that I want that. Now I'm just here, just to show you it's possible. Then I want you to translate that to your sponsor. I want you to find somebody and recover, and I want you to that it's possible for you to be close to somebody and somebody who can relate to where you've been and what you've been through, and who knows you better than I do because they have the condition you have. I want you to find that tonight at the NA meeting or whatever.
And that's, my fear is that I'm seeing everything through the attachment lens right now.
No, it's a useful, Bob does that all the time.
What do you mean by that?
Bob talks about that all the time.
That I'm seeing addiction as like an attachment disorder almost. You know what I mean? It's like you attach to a substance when you should be
attaching
to
like a person. It's more kind of, it's trauma and attachment. It's both. And I would argue that the attachment issues are growing out of the trauma. Okay. That they probably aren't. There are some for sure. Yeah. But I think that the reason it's so pervasive, it's either early childhood attachment issues and or trauma.
Yeah.
The two together creating these dysregulated, disorganized closeness, which I would argue is a big thing in this country right now. I mean, just about everybody. And it goes back to our families being so dysfunctional that they can't get those attachments in the beginning.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
It does.
Are we over your head still? Or are we?
No, I'm with you. Yeah. The question is, take it easy.
I'm just checking in.
The question is, though, when you attach to a patient and you have this relationship and then you're like, fly free, little wing. Does resentment develop, or they, an attachment to the sponsor doesn't come that easily?
Right. So just the way you asked the question tells you something about your attachment stuff. That you get overly enmeshed. You know, if you consider an attachment an enmeshment, I wouldn't let that happen to you. You would still have a proximity that didn't swallow you up.
Right.
So you could then go out independently.
Part of the attachment learning of how to healthy attachment is that relationship might end or look different
then and move. You can
right,
move. To move flexibly in.
No, I think that's accurate.
Let me say it. Well, no, you gave us the information.
I'm anxious avoidant. Where I'm like, I crave more from somebody, and then it gets close, and I'm like, I don't want any of that.
So am I. You know? I think I'm sort of more in the avoidant end of the anxious avoidant. Yeah, and. Oh, crap, what was I going to say about what you were just saying? What I think about how I verbalize this is tolerating flexible going and coming, flexibly going and coming in closeness. Mm-hmm. And people either get too intense or too connected. And if you're properly attuned, you won't let that happen in the therapeutic setting.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Wow, doctor. How much do I owe you?
We're usually talking about shooting puddle water.
Well but you know what deals with that somewhat is Al-Anon. Because Al-Anon patients all have that stuff.
Yeah.
And you were kind of alluding to some of that in your own background.
Yeah.
Is that whatever is going on the other person gets mobilized in me, and I try to solve that through various dysfunctions.
It's fascinating because I feel like even in all I was in therapy and I was in treatment
And like that, my shit was never really dealt with like that.
The deeper stuff,
not at all.
Well, because they're trying. Oh, somebody's at the door. They're trying to keep you alive. They're trying to get this drug addiction thing taken care of, and so they're probably doing CBT and just trying to solve problems in the moment. Mm-hmm. If you want to go deeper, I call that real recovery.
Yeah.
And then you've got to find like an emotionally focused therapist that understands addiction, or a trauma therapist that understands addiction. And it's hard to find that, and it's expensive and it's time consuming.
It is hard to find a therapist that's good. I mean, I'm one of those people who's emotionally focused, like working in the affective realm, that's with emotions in psychotherapy. I think that's has the biggest breakthroughs.
Yep.
But I'm horrible at it. Like, you know,
as a clinician or as a patient?
As a clinician, as a human being, just because like I'm good at taking somebody who doesn't want to feel feelings, that feels shame over and maybe holding their hands and feeling it. But when I've gotten clients who wear their feelings on their sleeve and are very open, who are would be very easy to work in the effective realm. It's too
much. That's your avoidance thing. That's your avoidance stuff.
And it's like this process I've learned to be a better clinician. It isn't going to be sort of didactics. It's going to be working on myself.
Experiential.
As a human being.
Experiential, man. Yeah. You got to get it. You got to get in the therapeutic setting and somebody who really is good at the EFT stuff.
And good supervision. Exactly. Yeah.
But that's great that you know that. You're way ahead. Most of your peers don't function on that level. Trust me.
But also knowing it is one thing. Another thing is having the courage to do the work to change.
Or you can just avoid those kinds of patients. Just work where your strength is. Yeah, you can do that.
I'm a sociopath.
Well, work where your strength is. That's okay. Yeah. You know.
I think that makes good sense. I like the sound of this stuff. I really do.
Yeah.
I don't like it on one hand, but I do on the other. I've always been super defiant to like clinicians, to teachers, to authority, just like I don't want to hear about it, and I don't want to like I've never been singled out for anything. I like kind of just blend in, and then I kind of like talk shit and I just disappear.
You snipe.
I've always been like that, and like thank God I got to get clean and like kind of I'm not in therapy anymore. Like maybe I should be.
I'm not saying that.
No, I'm not saying you're saying that. I'm saying I would like to get to this next phase. Like I don't even know what my
You may not need to. That's the point. It's like you have to want to do that. I knew there was something going on with me. I could feel it. And I knew it wasn't right. I sort of almost alexithymia. Like I was disconnected from emotions and things. And I wanted to get better. That's it. And then I got into it. I was like, oh, this is awesome. And I just kept going and going and going. I did a 3-year closure. In other words, I did 8 years of work, and then for about a year, I was stalling out. She goes, what are you doing here? And I go, I need to leave. I immediately started working again because that rapprochement, right? I had to leave all the way, and it took 3 years.
Yeah.
It's crazy. That's how awesome, delicate this stuff is, right?
Yeah. I was going to get my my KSAC in New York and then kind of pursue an MSW, but then I kind of have this family stuff happening, and it wasn't the time to do it. And then I kind of decided that I wanted to work on Dopey. Yeah. The idea of Dopey being a talk show, like The View is for women at home or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Dopey is a dope fiends talk show. Yeah, that's the idea.
You should
to keep them company.
But you should maybe do some Facebook Live and stuff. Maybe expand.
We've thought about doing it. The problem.
You could have people. There's. I don't know how long you been sober.
2.5 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're how long?
4.5.
Yeah. So you guys are kind of believe it or not, you're newbies, believe it or
totally.
Not. And you got to get to 5, and so, you know, so do you. But at that point, you could bring in people who are struggling.
Yeah.
We do you know.
We do. We already do. And
okay,
we try
be careful.
To be kind of judicious
about
that.
Yeah, be really careful.
Yeah.
Because like I said, we were talking about somebody else, and I first thing I said was, don't let that person take you down.
I had that
and
feeling.
And I didn't know how long you had been sober, but I know that can happen.
So we've been sober, and also we met 7 years ago. You know, so we both relapsed after we first met.
You were sober there and had relapse. Yeah.
We met in treatment. Yeah. And
I tried to take him out
a bunch of times. But I, you know,
exactly what you're talking about.
And I haven't done, I haven't shot dope in 6 years.
Yeah.
I just wound up smoking weed for a few years and then like losing track of my family and being like, I need to just put this out of my life.
You don't get to do that. You're a drug addict.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's
what I'm preaching nowadays.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard the story. I work in this restaurant downtown and I see this guy in the restaurant and me and Chris had just been doing dopey for maybe 8 months or something. Yeah. And we have a list of dream guests and maybe number 3 on the dream guest is Bob Farr.
Yeah, I tried reaching out to him.
And I see a man and I said, this guy looks like fucking Bob Forrest.
Probably
he's
is
got
him.
The hat. He's yeah. got glasses.
Nobody else. Nobody
like
else
that.
Wears a hat all day.
And then I go back to work, and then I'm like, and he's with his wife and his kid. And I'm like, you're not Bob Forrest, are you? He goes, well, yes, I am. And I was like, holy shit! And I run downstairs and I grab the dopey cards, and he's like, he was in town to see the Chili Peppers.
Yeah, he was just here. That was just recently, right? Like a couple months ago.
This was a different time. This was before. This was like a year ago.
A year ago.
Well, he comes here all the time, so yeah. He'd be a great guest for
he's
you.
Been he's been on like three times.
Oh, okay.
He's been like three times he gave now, yeah. us what's his face? What's the guy? The MTV guy.
Matt Pinfield?
He gave us Matt Pinfield. Yeah. He gave us Alexis Nares.
He's given us great guests.
We're hoping that you might be able to blossom some more people to come
in. Well, my problem is I can't admit who I've been involved with.
Yeah, because
you know what I mean?
What about we have the list from celebrities.
Well, I was going to say, unless it happened publicly. And, and the person who pulls that off is my wife.
You know who I want.
To her, she'll pull that off.
I want Steven Adler. How's he doing?
Bob would know for sure. He still is in touch with Bob. But he likes the marijuana maintenance. That's his big problem. He's way – oh, my God. He's infinitely better from where he was. His wife is – I saw her the other day, and I was like, oh, my God, you're so much better. She her codependency and stuff. And she now knows it, sees it, gets it, understands what she's dealing with. And
what do you think about the marijuana maintenance thing? I worked for a guy, Joe Schrank, sober living here, the guy who started The Fix, and he opened High Sobriety. And I'm like, I think there's a few people it might help. They'd probably take everybody, though, so it's going to hurt.
Right. Well, look, it's not – I'd rather have somebody on cannabis than an opiate.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to talk about Suboxone, Methadone, or Kratom, I'd rather have them on cannabis.
Yeah.
If it's, you know, I'm open to shooting galleries and alcohol houses where people are allowed to drink, where we can get you and hold you and start to talk about motivation.
Working towards.
Yeah. So I don't mind that if that's the model.
Yeah.
If it's, we're going to put you on a replacement, whether it's pot, cannabis, whether it's cannabis, Suboxone or Methadone, I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
Here's why. I don't get you.
Yeah.
That will never happen. If you had gone down that road, you wouldn't be sitting here inspiring me today. And so and if somebody, it works and it reduces their, it's harm avoidance and it helps them live and survive and they're functioning again.
Yeah.
They're still chronically ill.
Yeah.
They're not fully recovered.
Yeah.
God bless them.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in being involved with that.
We talk about this all the time. And so like all the research, you know, with Suboxone, I totally support Matt and Suboxone method on that stuff. But it's like you're showing all these statistics and it has to do with fatalities. And it's like quality of life doesn't factor into
That's right. So the problem is that, and they don't know addiction, that my peers do not understand addiction. That's the biggest problem of all. But so if survival is the only endpoint, I'm not interested in doing that work.
It's not going to get you out of bed.
I was on methadone for 6 years.
Yeah.
My life was terrible.
Of course.
I couldn't think straight. All I could do was take out-of-focus pictures of flowers, buy ice cream sandwiches, make bad food.
Yeah, but you were alive.
We talk about this all the time.
But maybe it got
maybe
you.
Maybe it kept you.
You're right. Maybe it kept you alive long enough where you did get sober. Methadone is not the one I would choose for that because that's a rough drug. But be that as it may, it's complicated, right?
Yeah.
The way I've sort of framed it is, I am sick of the excessive enthusiasm for this. It is, and now there's a guy named Keith Humphrey. You ought to interview these guys. A guy named John Kelly at Harvard, Keith Humphreys at Stanford, who are collecting the data on abstinence-based treatments. And lo and behold, mutual aid societies are as good or superior to everything else, and they are
What is that mutual aid society?
12-step.
Yeah.
Okay. And they are fucking free.
Yeah.
And why we are not advocating wholeheartedly for that.
Yeah.
There are not enough therapists on earth to sit on drug addicts in their early recovery the way they need to be sat on.
And even if there was, you couldn't afford it.
You can't afford it. And people stay sober by being the people that do that for the newbies.
Yeah.
It's a perfect system and it works.
Yeah.
And it's worked for decades.
Yeah.
And this is what I was yelling at the VA guy about. It's like, you need a campaign to stop talking about Suboxone. Go ahead and do your Suboxone thing. Yeah, it'll save some lives. Campaign for 12-step, and this resistance to 12-step is anathema. It makes me insane.
Where is it from?
I think it's coming from angry alcoholics that don't want to recover.
And that's where
I think it comes
from. We're both 12-step guys, and it has that underpinnings of Christianity. They see the word God, and they get scared.
But you know
that's
what?
That's not really what it is.
I've always said, whatever that means to you, all I need is you stop controlling everything, and you have to have faith in something that the world's not going to spin off its axis. So I don't care what it is. You figure it out for yourself.
The great reality within.
We've been talking about the Matrix.
We've been talking about this all day.
But be that as it may, there has to be – well, be that as it may, we are in a spiritual vacuum in this country. There's spiritual depravity everywhere, and we need to solve that problem.
Yeah.
And the idea of something bigger than yourself is at the core of that, solving that problem.
Yeah.
And so why we can't be honest about that and talk in a non-religious manner about it, religious if you want, is bizarre. I think maybe because we came through that sort of time of tea parties and hard right, you know, religious groups and stuff, that people were resistant to that. And I get that.
Yeah.
But let's get over that and let's just see where this can be useful for you because it does work empirically.
Yeah.
There's a Cochrane study about to come out, and you should interview these two guys, Humphreys and Kelly. They're about to publish major studies that show how effective it is.
But I think that there's a disconnect, and I really believe this, from most 12-step meetings with spiritual fitness. You can go to 12-step meetings all week and hear, just don't have the first drink, keep coming back. And
some
you don't
are,
hear about spiritual fitness.
And but spiritual that's why you shop around, though. That's why
I know, but I'm saying, like, I agree with his idea in terms of advocating for 12 steps. But within the 12-step community, advocating for spiritual fitness is like it's not happening.
Yeah. Well, the meetings are self-governing, and that's why you look around. You find one that
– I'm not sure what you're complaining about.
Well, I'm not complaining because I go to a big book study now, and
you've been up to the Atlanta group lately?
No. I live in Long Island now.
Do you ever go to that group?
I actually don't mind the Atlantic. They do book-based stuff.
Yeah.
They are very shaming if you say anything.
Yes.
But it's very much the core of what AA originally
yes.
was. But what I Park Street, I used to get – there's one of the largest meetings in New York City is an Atlantic group meeting. Have you been to that one?
No. And I'm not talking shit. I'm more concerned because I have so many friends who like
–
they just hear – my disease is in the parking lot doing push-ups and while you're sitting in the meeting and all this weird cliche stuff that isn't advocating spiritual fitness and doing the next right thing and operating from a place of godliness.
I would argue whatever that is as you conceive of it. And I would argue that is the sponsor's job.
Yeah.
So what you're telling me is people are not getting involved.
They're not getting sponsors.
They're not getting sponsors. Right. And I always said, I know I said it to you because I said it to everybody at Las Vegas, no sponsor, no treatment. No sponsor, no treatment.
Well, Chris,
no sponsor, forget
P&B?
It.
Yeah. Tell that story.
But I even think he was pretty good, and it's something that I probably could have got out of. Ultimately, I was somebody who had to go through the book line for line and have a very sort of detailed step-driven path to recovery, where I had other sponsors before that were sort of just looser, you know what I mean, which is what he's talking
then
about.
Then you fire your sponsor, move
That's
on.
That's it. Yeah. I fired and went to someone. But what Drew's talking, though, is on a macro level, more mutual self-help. And it's like it doesn't even have to be – I mean, I support – I mean, it's not
– More community.
Refuge Recovery.
Yeah. Oxford House,
Oxford,
whatever. Yeah.
Smart Recovery.
Smart Recovery. I'm game with everything.
One
more
guy
community.
Helping another guy.
Yeah.
Guy.
More
I hear
community.
You. I'm not against it.
But I'm hearing what you're saying, and I'm processing it, and I'm thinking, okay, people aren't getting sponsors. Too many people on Suboxone and benzos at the meetings.
Yeah.
You know, all that. Too many newbies and people. That means people are in and out, in and out, because every meeting is like a newbie meeting, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of what you're complaining about, is that none of them are evolving with a core group.
I wasn't complaining. No. When I complain, you'll know I'm fucking
that's,
complaining.
But I see that. That, I think, is what it's symptomatic of.
We have this friend. A friend who I used with forever, and he comes on dopey, and he never got clean, and he's finally clean.
Yeah.
And he says he struggles with
God.
He's
2 weeks. He's got 2 weeks.
Fine, but he's been in and out.
Yeah,
he's been in a million places, and he hates meetings because I don't think he's ever gotten this beautiful actual message that comes out of the book.
Well, it's like I went to 100 meetings before I went to a meeting. Do you know what I mean? I was going to meet into Las Encinas, and I was like, I didn't hear you. And then, like, all of a sudden, I heard something finally, you know, and, like, that was a turning point.
To
focus in on what that was and see if you can bottle it. I'm serious.
What the turning point was?
Yeah, what that moment was when you heard something.
The turning point actually happened a couple years before. And I was at McLean Hospital. I was seeing a psychiatrist.
Being fucking everywhere.
Crazy.
Into the circle.
Crazy psychiatrist, okay? Yeah. I'll say his name. I'm friends with him. He has a checkered history. His name is Dr. Burn. I love him. I would not recommend him to most people. He does research on psychedelics, and he was doing my biopsychosocial. I was taking these, this is 10 years ago, these weird things called research chemicals, which most people didn't know. It was like 2CB, 2CI, it was tryptamines and stuff like that, yeah. Manufactured in China and shipped over. And I was injecting, I was getting my ass kicked by him. And he looks down and he sees, he's like totally checked out. He's like, it wasn't really. And then he sees I did hallucinogenics. And he's like, it's kind of weird. You know, usually I'm a junkie, cokehead, alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah, that's how you should part of the
mix. I'm still doing hallucinogenics. Yeah. And he's like, what hallucinogenics are you doing? And I'm like, I'm doing these things called research chemicals. Like, you wouldn't even know what they are. And he just knew everything about it. And in that moment, he got my respect. And I was like, most physicians didn't know anything about these research chemicals. And he said, and I had already done yoga. He said, go do Ashtanga yoga. He's like, you can get with mindfulness-based practices what you're looking for with hallucinogenics. Yeah. I like that glimpse into something beyond myself. Yeah. I've always believed in something else.
Okay.
And that's what I like taking hallucinogenics for. So I left there and I did that. And I took Suboxone and I practiced yoga.
Do anything with Suboxone? Yeah.
But for the first time, that bondage of self, that feeling restless, irritable, and discontent that was untreated alcoholism, it got a little bit better, you know? And like
the mindfulness helped. So that's a really great note.
But I became willing to listen to somebody else.
Yeah.
I relapsed, went to treatment, met Dave. My counselor was ex-Hell's Angel, like what I needed, right?
Yeah.
And he was like, do AA. And it's like, I didn't want to do it forever. I liked yoga because it was isolated. I didn't have to connect. And I just became willing. I was like, I listened to this one other doctor. I'm going to listen to this guy. I listened. I showed up. I heard people who had my story. I was someone who was like, I couldn't even – someone – they had to shoot coke for me to listen. IV coke. They had to be a dope addict. They had to be shooting dope. If they were still catching a nod off their dope, I couldn't listen. And they had to be a total alcoholic. Or I – you know what I mean? Or it's like I couldn't listen to anything. And then I met my sponsor. You know what I mean? All those things. You know, I met a guy who eventually became my sponsor. And I started to hear things for the first time. So it's like, that's me trying to bottle up as best as I can, you know? And
well, I like the turn. I like there's a turn.
Before hearing something in a meeting.
Yeah, so there was a weird...
In that moment.
So it was a shared something with that doctor.
But along the way, there were people. Bob Forrest, you know, my sister runs a nationwide addiction and eating disorder company. And she always asked, like, who were people? And I always said good things about you. I remember going to your Wednesday thing.
Lectures.
And it was, I remember being very impressed, and I really liked it. Bob Forrest was somebody.
Yeah.
And it was like he had that ability to sort of connect with somebody.
Yes, he does.
And these were all people along the way who were helpful. There was like people I don't even remember their names. You know what I mean? But finally what happened is I became willing, and there happened to be somebody there, and something happened. You know?
Yeah.
And then
that's it. The bricks start getting laid down, and then boom. And Bob was treated 28 times or something. And he says he thinks every one of those treatments was useful.
Yeah.
He doesn't regret one of them.
And that's maybe where we can look at something like the high sobriety or Suboxone or anything as a chance to get to the path.
Right, right. I try not to judge. You know, I just know the stuff I will be a part of and stuff I'm not interested in being a part of. That doesn't mean it's wrong. Yeah.
I know that for me, like, whenever I did any kind of substance, there was no way that I wasn't going to do everyone.
Well, I don't want to plant any different ideas than that, but I would agree that certain real addicts, that's almost always the case. Mm-hmm. But we've created all these sort of intermediate addicts now. Doctors have created all these opiate dependent sort of non addicts. They're not like you guys.
Yeah.
There's like a different category now.
What is that category?
It hasn't been characterized really. That's why substance use disorder is getting broken down to so many different.
And to continue your 12-step thing, I think sometimes those people find their way into 12-step programs and they're not really good people. That's why you pick a sponsor that you has something that you want and that you feel like shares your affliction. Do you know what I mean? So he's saying those intermediate people, they might come in, they're going to get a ton out of
the
program.
They'll get a lot
they're
going to
get better.
Yeah.
But it's like, I needed someone who's like you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right. And that group, I don't know what the replacement stuff for them. They're not going to be normal on replacement. They're not going to be well.
Yeah.
They're not going to be thriving. I'm interested in thriving and full recovery.
Yeah.
That's what I'm interested in. And so I know that's not going to happen when you're taking a substance. It doesn't mean the substance is bad. It doesn't mean that anybody else who's not an addict couldn't use that substance.
Yeah.
I don't think substances are good or bad. They're just people use things.
Yeah.
But for you, it's a no. And for most of those people that are struggling and are not, you know, the kind of addict you guys are, they will never fully thrive. Yeah. It will always keep them from a full recovery.
Can we ask you a question?
Yeah.
Have you ever done drugs?
I did.
This is going to be a soundbite, all right?
We don't do soundbites.
You're sending it to Good Morning America?
Yeah. You're going to make some money from this.
Yeah. No, I did. Yeah. I did. I did. Like, alcohol is still something I use occasionally. Yeah. I used pot briefly. In fact, I think it had. I had severe panic attacks in college, and I think it's why they precipitated so severely.
Really?
Yeah. I think that's what happened.
You think that
I think
cannabis pushed you to the cliff.
Not when I was using. I think it opened up that circuitry. So when I started getting depressed and I started having trouble and getting anxious, it opened that circuit where panic dropped in.
Yeah.
And panic is terrible. It's just disabling. Yeah. And cocaine a bit in the 80s, you know, like everybody else. But you know, I didn't have any momentum with anything. Thank God. You know, I'm a lightweight.
I want to change pace for one quick second. With celebrity, I love celebrity. Was it celebrity rehab or celebrity detox?
Celebrity rehab.
I was using. I was living. I was hot.
Yeah.
I was living in Echo Park, and I watched any show that had people on drugs. I was like, let me get high with them.
You were in Los Angeles?
Oh yeah, I was in Los Angeles for 6 years.
Just to run drugs?
No, I grew up here, and I lived in public housing. I got.
He had an MTV show, and he blew it all.
Yeah, I blew a million. I had a lot of consequences. But I wound up in Los Angeles because I lost my apartment here, and I was like, fuck it. If I could produce TV in New York at 22, I had a deal. I was like, in high school, I was on MTV. I was like, I can produce something in LA, no problem. I wound up there as an associate producer on some show. In the bathroom, I had a tissue box full of needles in the public bathroom in the drawer.
Nice.
I disappeared constantly. Maybe I produced there for 3 months, and then I was just full-time addict. I got a girl, and I lived with her. I got on the methadone program, and I walked around in a bathrobe like Brian Wilson.
It's fantastic.
But when I
in Echo Park, which now is gentrified.
Yeah, I was there right before.
Yeah.
But when I was there, I would watch Celebrity Rehab, and I loved it. I really did.
You'd sit and go, oh, those guys are I'm not like, look at those guys.
Well, I would love it when they'd run out, and I'd be like, go, be free, go, get high, do your thing. But then, you know, you hear people say that it was irresponsible to make a show like that.
Okay.
What do you say to that?
You got to get specific with me.
Okay,
in other words, like the goal was to pull back the curtain on treatment and show what addiction is and what treatment is. Mm-hmm. That was our goal. I think we achieved it. We had lots of people coming into treatment because they saw it, not because they were coming for us. Because
it looked good. Awesome, though.
Well, we'd always hear was, I saw this, I saw that. It was like my story, and I couldn't deny it anymore, so I'm coming to treatment.
Yeah.
We'd hear a lot of that.
Yeah. How's Flavor doing?
Flavor.
Wasn't Flavor Flav on it once?
No.
Didn't he hook up with What's-Her-Face on it?
That was on, what was that play? Another reality show.
But she was on.
She was on.
Yeah. Okay, so Flavor never showed up. He could have really used it.
Maybe. I don't know him.
I love Flavor.
I'm glad you love Flavor.
How's she doing?
Intermittently. She's doing pretty good. She struggles a little bit.
But to go back to I've heard
but,
that before.
But here's what you hear. Here's what you'll hear. Yeah. First of all, the big criticism, what we struggle with was, what do we do about 12-step? What do we do? How do we present that on television?
Anonymously.
Right. So we first season, didn't mention it at all.
Yeah.
What did we hear from the 12-step community?
What
the fuck? Why don't you use 12-step? Yeah. So then we sort of carefully adapted a model of we called the steps assignments. You know, we'd use codes and we'd say, you're going to your meetings. We wouldn't say what kind of meetings.
Yeah.
So we had this sort of thing going on where they could see we were doing 12-step. But we might have even said 12-step. We certainly didn't say any particular program.
Yeah. Right.
And that's kind of how we solved that problem. Yeah. What I always hear is, you're exploiting people.
Yeah.
And that's a confusing one to me, because every one of those patients had a great experience. If you were exploited, wouldn't you feel exploited? And I encourage you to go ask any of them that were in that treatment. They all had this. Here's what we didn't know that I was very, very grateful for. They all had the same experience, which was every single, whether it was the sex addiction show or whatever, was the same exact phenomenon happened every single time. They came in wanting to be on TV, wanting to be paid, not giving a shit, wanting to destroy our program, wanting to give us crap. And some of them, because we were very serious about our treatment, we just calling them by their name, not whatever their porn name was or their or their celebrity name was, they would jar them and they'd be like, oh my God, why are they calling me that? And we would just keep at them, keep at the treatment. And every single one of them went from resistant to, oh my God, this is a good thing. I'm getting something out of this. In every single one, by the end of treatment, was like, "Hey, I want to share this. I want to be a role model. I want to share this with other people."
The facades really fell down.
It was uncanny. It was really maybe one didn't do that of all the people we treated, and that didn't mean they were a straight line to recovery. I mean, we know that they're still going to struggle and stuff, but they felt good about their treatment. And they felt good about presenting it to the world. Yeah. And here's one other, and these are celebrities, right? So the first. I forgot. I haven't talked about this in so long. The first season, I was very anxious about, you know, what the effects of the cameras were going to have. And every group I'd start, well, are you guys okay? Are you all right? All right? Is this bothering you? And every day I do that. Finally, Mary Carey, the porn star, looks at me and she goes, Drew, I've done pretty much everything in front of a camera. Cameras do not bother me. This is not going to be an issue. Trust me. And it turned out people that are used to being in front of cameras, they know what they're getting into. They all knew what that meant.
But isn't it different fucking in front of a camera than revealing your soul?
I didn't ask her that. Whatever it was, they all felt comfortable. But here's the conundrum. So the other criticism we got was, oh, you only do celebrities. And in real life, you know, I didn't do that many celebrities. I had regular people. So I said, well, let's do a regular people show. So we did a regular person show. Yeah. No one watched it. Yeah. Nobody watched it. And I could tell that group, although some of them are doing so remarkably well, people are like you, tough. Yeah. They gave me they were the toughest. They were way worse than the celebrities in many ways. I could tell the cameras were like turning them on a little bit. It bothered me. It was like, this is not good.
Yeah.
So I will never do again.
Yeah.
No one has ever brought that up to me.
Yeah.
But that's where I thought we had a problem. Yeah. And now, fortunately, they all did pretty well, and we gave them lots of resources and lots of treatment. And the other thing is they all get treatment afterwards, too. They're given hundreds of thousands of dollars of treatment. Yeah. Now, a lot of them turn it down.
Yeah. Was that on VH1, too, the normal people one?
That we got more treatment afterwards?
No.
It was on VH1. Yeah, it was just called Rehab.
I think I might have watched it.
And so, you know, it wasn't like we took care of them afterwards if they would participate. A lot of them won't, you know how it goes. And I always thought VH1 sort of take a bow for how they funded the treatment afterwards. I just insisted on it.
That's awesome.
And, you know, so the criticism has to be very specific.
Well, it's a treat to hear that because I've heard that before. I've heard some of the criticism, and to hear your response.
I needed to bring it up.
I always defend you, and I'd be like, look, I met Dr. Drew.
Yeah.
Like, he is like a real person.
Yeah.
He's a real doctor, and he cares about his patients.
Yeah.
And like, I think that.
And these guys, because they're celebrities, it doesn't matter to me. I don't give a shit. Yeah. I don't care.
Yeah.
They're drug addicts in need.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah. And you've been around celebrity enough to know that it's just another job. Mm-hmm. And then these people are fucking spiritually ill and fucking fucked.
Yeah.
So like they need help, and it's the Hippocratic Oath.
The stuff I would get from criticism from professionals would, why didn't you show CBT? Why didn't you show fancy or this and that?
Yeah.
That's not TV.
We
did that. It didn't show up on television.
Yeah. So why did it stop?
It's expensive because I made them. First of all, they all want to be paid to be on TV. That's how you got them in. And by the way, what's wrong with that? Do you care what motivates somebody to come into treatment? If you can pay them to come into treatment, and somebody's got the money to pay them, bring them in. That's fine.
Like a whole type of treatment now.
Yes, they're doing that now. That's right.
That's
and so there's that. People will criticize that too. Like, well, you paid them to come in. Yes. I don't care what they came in with. They wanted cameras and pay. Good. I don't care how I get them. That I get them is what counts. Shoot, I lost my train of thought. What were you saying that
I was?
My peers. So yeah, the stuff that shows up on TV is not. It's not treatment is boring for the most part, and it doesn't. So the stuff that shows up on TV is just the conflicts and the chaos and the withdrawal and all the stuff that happens on a drug unit every time.
Yeah.
Every time you go on a drug unit, mishigas ensues. It just does.
But 80% of it's not that too. There's a lot of other stuff going on.
But what goes on TV is the mishigas. Yeah.
So when you look back, you've done so many different shows and so many cool projects, and obviously things that were not entertainment based at all. No. Like Chris, he's very entertaining. But, What were your most proud things that you got to do?
And what's your future too? If you don't,
past and present.
The future has always been like an exploration. I don't know. It's always like Celebrity Rehab. A couple guys showed up and went, "We're going to do this thing," and I went, oh, you can't do that. Yeah. And they were like, well, come on with us and try to figure it out. And what I did then with that project, I thought, well, it's good to go pitch, and it's an interesting idea. We'll see if somebody can morph it into something. Yeah. And the whole time I kept going, you guys can't, you know, you can't do this. You can't go in a hospital. You can't do this.
Yeah.
And eventually somebody got interested, and then I went to hiding, by the way. When VH1 got interested, I was like, oh, shit. Well, you don't know this story. This is an interesting part of the story. I was like, this is, I'm not sure I want to do this. Bob came into my office one day. He didn't know I'd been pitching that show, or I'd been with these guys who were pitching the show. It was not my idea. It was somebody else's idea. He came in my office, and he sat down in that chair. We would always put the patients in, you know, that chair?
Yep.
He sat down in there, and he goes, you know, I am so sick of our patients, meaning some of the celebrities we had treated, being portrayed in television as on a spa vacation or making excuses for their behavior.
Yeah.
These people are sick.
Yeah.
They do work hard in treatment.
Yeah.
Drew, we need to do a TV show where we show that.
He had no clue.
No idea.
Oh,
and I was I was like, I got cold sweat.
That's,
I was
like synchronicity or something.
Oh my God, Bob, I'll trust your instincts. If you really think this is something you show, somebody is approaching you with this. And he goes, absolutely. I remember he slapped his hands on his knees and jumped up, went, we got to do it. And he just stormed out. And I was like, okay. Yeah, she's used to Bob now. It's, that's a typical kind of Bob thing. Yeah. And I thought, all right, I'm going to go forward. We'll see what happens. That's why it happened.
God. That's awesome.
So I'm proud that we pulled the curtain back on that, and it became a little bit of a cultural conversation as a result. Loveline, you know, that was, to me, that all started because of HIV and AIDS. I was working a lot of AIDS patients then. It was a horrible, dark, tragic time that people have forgotten about, and it motivated me to get on the air and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an opportunity, and so I just kept doing it. I did it for free for 10 years and just thought I was doing community service. And then it morphed into a TV show, and I was like, I don't know, what's that? So I just sort of go through the doors. And I have dialed back a lot of my clinical stuff. I'm sort of officially on to my second career, which is focusing on radio and television, see what I can do with it.
Awesome.
I never didn't really focus on it before. I just sort of would kind of explore it, do it. You know.
Do you still have a private practice?
Anybody I do, but I do a lot of sort of consulting and stuff for people are calling me about addiction problems every day. I don't have a formal practice in that. My practice is general internal medicine, patients I follow for 30 years that I just keep taking care of.
Gotcha.
And I stopped doing inpatient medicine. I stopped doing inpatient psych. And
yeah.
I sort of crammed three physician careers into, you know, one 20-year period where I was doing inpatient medicine, outpatient medicine, and then all this addiction stuff in the psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
And it was a very rich experience. I love the human experience. I love humanity. I love people. And sort of have that window, and no greater window than a drug addict.
Yeah.
You because when your motivational systems are broken, you see how everything else falls victim to it.
Yeah.
And so your thinking, your emotions, your interactions with other people, it's all under this distorted motivation. And it's just fascinating.
I think with this spiritual lens, and this is maybe going a little deep right here.
We're going to the Matrix. Here we go.
Well, I mean, God's greatest gift, if you will, is free will. You know what I mean? The ability
but you lose
choose.
That with addiction.
And you do. So it's we've gone. Had something tampered, you know, and what is the way out? I choose to see it's like the same, you know, it's through the same thing. God, however you define him, she, it, whatever.
Formalize that, because there really has never been kind of a philosophical approach to all this.
Yeah.
You know, there should be.
Yeah.
You know, what is the philosophy of free will when it doesn't work?
We'll figure that out on Dopey, maybe.
Well, that's
it'd be really it'd be a Dopey philosophy, though.
We had a Dopey philosophy. I forgot what it was. But there are two more questions. If you had, because if you're focusing on radio and television, what would your dream project be? Like, what would the show look like? Would it be like you like Maury Povich?
Right now,
would it be like you like Oprah? Or would it be like some? Do you have
right now, this I probably won't happen, but I keep having this idea. When I was on HLM, we did a couple of shows where we had an audience, and we would fill the audience with X type of person, all transgender, all Muslim, all black. And I would interact with them, and that to me is like...
That's pretty cool.
That was
powerful.
And they were great shows.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course, nobody watched them, but it was like, I'm very good at that, about tuning to what's going on and creating dialogue that moves the conversation forward for anybody who's watching and for the people in the room. Mm-hmm. And so that's my fantasy. No one seems to want to do that, but that's the kind of thing I'd like to do.
Yeah.
What an interesting idea, though.
Yeah. Because we are not talking in this country right now, and there's all these tribes, and I want to combat tribalism. Yeah.
I had this friend of mine, because I had made a little web series that I'll tell you about later, because that kind of protects my anonymity, and I was trying to get ideas to pitch, because I was working – we almost had you come down to this production company that I
did a shopping thing for. And my friend had this idea, because we weren't sure that Susan wanted us to come here or not. Yeah. And I had booked a studio just in case that would have made you feel better. Yeah. But we're happy to be here.
Yeah.
Anyway, my buddy pitched me this idea to do a show called Us Versus Them, where you bring in the group and in a studio situation. I just thought it was a funny idea.
No, it's not a funny idea. It's a good idea. And it's very television, right? That's what television wants right now. I'm not sure. My only concern about that, well, I like it. I do like the idea.
It's the versus.
Whether you'll get anywhere.
Right, you won't.
It's too cantankerous.
What was that guy, the Robert Downey III? What was that guy?
Yeah.
The Morton Downey Jr. show. Did you ever see that show? Mm-hmm. He was great.
Yeah.
It was classic New York. And then the most important question is, what do you think about my vision for Dopey? Yeah.
Which is?
A
talk show for
I see it as Regis with Kathy Lee.
Yeah.
With dope fiends. Yeah. And talking about the absurdity of using and the absurdity of being somebody that used trying to do the next right thing.
I gave you my thing about podcasts saving the world, right? And so I think you start there and you build your community. I would go to the Facebook Live or something like that, or YouTube or something.
Do you think we dress like cholos or something? How do we protect?
Bandanas? Yeah. I'm nervous. Clowns? I need to get licensed in a couple of years, you know, and it's like, I don't know if it's prudent for me to be.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
I think you need to be forthcoming about all of it when you get your license.
I already had to meet, before I went to start my school, they were like, you need to consult a healthcare attorney and see what's
going on. Yeah.
I can get licensed, but I'm just still, I don't know. You know what I mean? I'm nervous enough where I'm like, I want to keep it. You know, and then he has a family too. He doesn't want his daughter.
I don't want my daughter to Google our name and just see like seizures, IV, fucking all this stuff.
Because we say good stuff, but we say some pretty dark things as well. You know?
Give me an example.
Okay. One of my favorite dopey stories was me and my friend were getting high. I had a seizure. I ordered Mexican food.
Yeah.
I have a seizure.
Yeah.
The Mexican food gets there as I'm seizing. My friend freaks out, terrified, running around the house like a nervous wreck. Then there's a knock on the door. Somehow he opens the door and he's so panicked he faints.
Right?
I wake up from the seizure. I wake up. I see my friend on the floor in the doorway, the Mexican delivery guy standing over him.
Yeah. Like, what
happened here? Did this guy just kill my friend? It was like the most junky Seinfeld you could get.
Yeah. To me, that stuff is good. It needs to be shared.
But in third grade, your daddy's a fucking junkie. Yeah. Like, I don't want my daughter to have to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but she does have to deal with that.
At some point.
Yeah. At some point.
Yeah. It's about when.
Isn't it a good story, though?
It's a great story. It's a great story. And only addicts get their into these stories.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with not doing it because it's so important for people to hear these stories and to have a relationship with you and to see you and for other people to feel like they can step forward and share their stories.
So you're saying we should break anonymity.
Well, now, but anonymity is a – you can't promote 12-step. Right, in media. You can talk about your experiences a little bit.
You can say 12-step, which is kind of like the back door without saying A.
See, Bob and I, you get Bob in here to talk about this because he's very clear about this. We studied the 11th tradition and we read about it. We tried to figure out because it needs to be exposed to the media, to the world, but not promoted.
Right.
And those are two different things.
Yeah.
And so us talking, because it's a program of attraction. So us talking about the experience of what it is and how you do it, that's not promoting it. That's just talking about the attraction as opposed to somebody in the program getting, you know, saying we need to organize a media campaign for our 12-step group.
A lot of that came about from Rockefeller because Bill Wilson, when it started blowing up, he was like, let's create an AA hospital.
Yeah.
And he went to Rockefeller for money. And Rockefeller was like, actually, I think you got something good going on here. And like you shouldn't formalize
if
it.
Right. If you formalize marketing and that will ruin it. It'll be done. It'll be over.
Yeah.
This is a flexible, self-run program that needs to remain where it is.
Yeah. But not Dopey. Dopey needs marketing.
Well, I was going to say, your guys' anonymity versus not – I don't think the individual has to remain anonymous. I think that's
individuals. I mean, you saw the anonymous people, or you heard maybe of the show.
Yeah,
and that takes basically famous people. They come out and say, "I'm an alcoholic." And that's okay.
but it's different to say I'm a part of a program. I have a condition, as opposed to I'm going to share all my stories and how I recover and stuff.
Yes.
That's a little bit of a different deal. And You're early to be doing all this is really what we're what's going on.
Yeah.
It's really at the bottom of this. Yeah. It's too soon.
It's too soon.
Too soon.
Dr. Drew says too soon.
So when, Dr. Drew?
You're going to figure that with your sponsor.
Yeah.
Do you have a sponsor now?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that should be who we should be figuring that out with.
Yeah. And my sponsor doesn't love Dopey.
Well, so
doesn't love Dopey.
It's the same instinct I'm having. He probably thinks it's too soon.
He thinks that Dopey, though, could be some kind of non-profit thing.
Yeah,
that's his big vision for Dopey.
What's wrong with that?
No problem. We're just growing. We're just growing, Dr.
Just keep building the community. Yeah. Keep creating the attraction. Keep focusing on your recovery. Yeah. Everything will happen in its time.
The problem with us and Bob is that Bob calls us on the phone while he's driving.
Yeah, he's driving through, like, the hills.
Can't hear anything.
It's all fuzzy. We're like,
you know. He also doesn't respond to texts very often. It's like, it makes
me
crazy.
I'm sure Drew doesn't have that problem.
He has done that on my show. He's called in from his car to be on my show. Yes, he has done that. On his show with me. Yeah. It's not just my show. It's my show with him.
He's a joy. He's done that. Yeah. We love Bob.
Yeah.
And
we're
grateful to him. We're grateful to you. Come on.
Bob still does the junkiest shit you've ever seen.
We all do. It's kind of built in.
It's I glory in it. I can't. It's like, wow, you're such a junkie. It's so good.
Yeah.
He gets a little offended sometimes because he thinks he's outgrown most of that stuff. But
we all
still exist. Around,
but that's why I believe in Dopey, because it's those little quirks that are hysterical.
And human and rich and fine. They're fine.
Yeah.
And you got to embrace all that. But you can't let it run amok because it will get you.
Right. Totally. Yeah. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Privilege.
For having us here. And being
privilege. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for doing all that hard work. Good for you.
Yeah, thank
The only thing that I regret is that we didn't have a classic Dopey email to read, Drew. Do you have one?
Are these sort of war stories or something? Or?
No, there are people asking for help.
What do you do? Like, what do you do?
I have one queued up. Not a good
usually, one. You know, again, it'll be somebody like what Chris was going, fix me now. And I have no resources. What do I do?
No, Dopey, classic Dopey email is a story from somebody. And then they're usually like, I like your podcast or something like that.
Fuck it.
We'll send you, or I'll tell you when.
Thank you.
All right.
And,
thank you so much.
And, you know, go on Dopey Instagram and Twitter and Reddit and follow Dr. Drew at drdrew.com and him on Twitter and him on everything and Dr. Drew for president and for the people.
Let's go solve that opiate problem. This administration is, believe it or not, listening.
I had another question.
Does the Surgeon General have to be an actual surgeon?
No. This guy's an anesthesiologist, in fact.
So, Dr. Drew for Surgeon General.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to be in the military, though.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be a general.
Yeah. So he the guy that is the Surgeon General, though, is has a brother who's a meth addict in prison.
Oh, wow. That's great.
He's an anesthesiologist, so he has a weird – the anesthesiologists don't really get addiction very well, but I think we can get his ear. He's a nice guy.
One more question.
One more.
We were talking about this before. It's like I just watched a documentary about Johnny Thunders, the guitar player from the New York Dolls, who was a horrible junkie coming up in the 70s, and you're seeing all this footage of like open-air drugs on the streets of New York and how bad the heroin epidemic was then.
Yeah.
And right now, we're saying that it's the worst, the opiate epidemic.
That was nothing.
Okay.
That was nothing compared to this.
Yeah. So but this is fentanyl and carfentanyl.
This is physician-initiated.
It started,
Oral prescription opiates. Yeah. If they don't die when the doctor adds the benzodiazepine in, then the doctor realizes he or she has a problem. They cut them off. They go to the street. That's how heroin happens.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Once on the street, it's mixed with fentanyl, carfentanyl. Now you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Joe.
Okay,
thank you, Dr. Joe.
You have to say, stay strong, Dopey Nation.
Stay strong, Dopey Nation.
And toodles.
You don't have to say toodles.
Wait, what's the one? What do the juggalos do?
The ICP people?
Yeah, they have a greeting. Whoop, whoop. That's the thing.
Chris says toodles.
All right, stay strong, Dopey Nation. Toodles.
I want to take a walk around the world. I wonder would it do me any good? Until I get some money in my pocket, then I guess I'll just have to walk around my neighborhood. But I want to be good so bad. Want to be so good, so bad, so bad. I want to be good so bad. Bad desire's all I ever had. And I want to take a ride up in the sky. Watch as airplanes just pass me by. And I want to see a Lear jetliner take a dive. Just to show all of these people what it means to be alive, but I wanna be good so bad. Wanna be so good, so bad, so bad. I wanna be good so bad. Bad desire's all I ever had. And my shadow's getting smaller and smaller. And it's time to where I stand. Shadow's getting smaller and smaller. And it's time to where I stand. And I wonder would they pay it any mind when I leave this busted city far behind. I'll take the high road, however far it winds, because peace and love are very, very, very hard to find. And I wanna be good so bad. Wanna be good so bad, so bad. I wanna be good so bad. Bad desire's all I ever had. Damn it, all these suckers make me mad. And it's all I ever had. It's all I ever had. And these suckers make me mad, and I want to call my dad. And it's all I ever had. 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 And these suckers make me mad, and it's all